Are you looking to give your immune system a boost? This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a natural solution from Future Farm Botanicals, liquid wild oil of oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's wild oil of oregano supports a variety of health benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate wild oil of oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. Future Farm sources this product from the Mediterranean and produces it in the United States. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com. /Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking to Liz Lipsky. Liz is the author of Digestive Wellness, now just out in its fifth edition. It's a marvelous encyclopedic book about digestive health, but not just about digestive health, about how altering your digestive status in a positive way can have a big impact on all manner of disorders, fibromyalgia, migraine, skin conditions, autoimmune diseases, even heart disease, osteoporosis. There's a section on osteoporosis and digestive health. Liz, you know, one of the most common problems for which people get prescription medication or over-the-counter medication, because it's now been made generic, GERD, reflux. What's up with that?
I think a lot of different things are up with that. You know, we love to name things and assume that everybody has the same issue just because they have the same symptoms, and it's not always true. So for some people, stress is their main reason why they're having heartburn. I had a friend who came to visit me while I was living in Hawaii, and he showed up at my house with this lifetime size bottle of antacids. And then he started spending time eating with my family for a month and going to the beach every day. And you know what? His GERD completely went away. He was eating better. He was relaxing. He was exercising.
So the prescription is a trip to Maui and a 3-month sojourn at your house.
I think so, but I don't live there anymore. So okay. You have to find somewhere else to stay. So, so I think stress is a huge factor. I think also the types of food that people eat. I mentioned on part one that 71% of the food that Americans are eating is ultra processed. And so it's the life in food that gives us life. So I think it's important for people to eat real food and to cook food and to actually sit at a table and make that kind of a relaxing event rather than eating at their desk or eating in their car or eating standing up in the kitchen. Hurried eating contributes to GERD. And then some people experience a lot of heartburn from specific foods. Some people have heartburn from eating tomatoes or peppers or high acid foods. And then there are other people I found who, I had one client, every time she ate eggs, we discovered, you know, by process of elimination, every time she ate eggs, she had GERD.
So that's a very idiosyncratic response, what we like, very individualized. In other words, most people tolerate eggs, but for this particular person, they would set her off. So you have to do some detective work to determine what works, what doesn't work. You do a trial of an elimination diet, and then maybe reintroduce foods if you're feeling better, right?
Yeah, that's how we figured it out. And I've also had other people I've worked with who gluten or dairy is their issue. So again, you know, it's like if you have GERD, like start thinking about, well, what might be contributing to that GERD? And start maybe try an elimination diet. I think I have one up even on my book website that people can download. And just try an elimination diet for a couple weeks and see what happens. there's...
So you need to sort of make yourself a science fair project, you know, like your own personal science fair project, and discover what works and what doesn't work. It takes a little time, a little detective work, but often you can ascertain, you know, the specific things that may be triggers for you.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer in us being science experiments. You know, you live in your body, hopefully, for 80 years. Like, if I was going to live in a house for 80 years, I would take really good care of that house. And if the roof started leaking, I would get up there and I would patch that roof. And, you know, and I don't think we take as good care of our bodies because they're so miraculous. They're self-healing. But at a certain point, they just kind of start saying, okay, enough is enough. I just can't do it. I don't have the right nutrients. I don't have the raw materials. You work 18 hours a day and you don't rest, so I don't have time to repair myself. And, you know, so I'm a big believer in self-care and self-inquiry about our body.
So it sounds like there are different subtypes of GERD, you know, different strokes for different folks. Mm-hmm. One thing that I learned from Dr. Atkins, whom I knew very well during my early career in New York, he was going great guns at the Atkins Center right here in Manhattan, is that almost as a beneficial side effect of a lot of people going on weight loss diets with his low-carb diet, the Atkins diet, they reported, okay, yeah, the pounds melted off, but also their gastrointestinal problems often got better. Now, this is not always the case, because as you say, it's very individual. There are different subtypes of GERD. But for some people, lowering the impact of starchy grains and sugar and certainly sugary beverages can alleviate GERD, right?
Yeah, so this excites me a lot, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking about this and also lecturing about this a lot. What we know is that the food we eat has the biggest effect on changing the microbiome. And we know that the microbiome affects whether we're fat or thin or happy or sad or, you know, systemic health. So what we eat really makes a difference. And what the microbes in the gut like to eat is carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. So when we're eating a high sugar, high carbohydrate diet, if they're out of balance, they go insane and they make us feel really sick and they produce substances that aren't good for us. So when we go on a low carbohydrate diet, like the Atkins diet, or some people are doing a paleo immune type diets, or low FODMAP diet, or specific carbohydrate diet, what happens is that you starve out all those fungi and those bacteria that secrete little toxins called lipopolysaccharides that make your gut leaky. You start starving all of them, and you start almost immediately, within a couple of weeks, starting to feel so much better. And it's pretty exciting when somebody experiences that, because in 2 weeks, people, I'm sure you see this all the time, in 2 weeks, people go, wow, I haven't felt this good, you know, for years.
Yep, indeed. I mean, we've literally had people who have avoided esophageal surgery, you know, this so-called Nissen fundoplication, that they thought they needed because they weren't responding anymore to the PPI medication that they were taking. You know, with the diet change, they learned that, you know, the medication wasn't even necessary. So
it's so great.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's so great.
But for a lot of people, you know, they say, you know, this sounds a little tedious. You know, there are these remarkable medications that alleviate stomach discomfort and GERD, reflux. What's the downside of taking these things long term? I mean, I just spoke to someone who said her doctor says it's okay to take it for your lifetime. I mean, it's working, isn't it? So you might as well just take it until you meet your maker.
Ron, you and I both know that these were originally approved for 12 weeks.
Right. rhetorical question, big time. I'm pitching you a big high hanging curveball for you to hit out the park.
I know. So anyway, they were originally for short term use. And they work amazingly well. The proton pump inhibitors, what they do is they block the production of acid in your stomach, which is
originally
what makes
you... For ulcers, for like, you know, people have bleeding ulcers. I mean, yeah, okay, I get it. You know, you got to turn off the acid to allow some healing. But they have now been co-opted and their use has been extrapolated for the tens and tens of millions of Americans who have GERD, heartburn, indigestion, such a common complaint.
And they're being used for children, too. Oh, yeah. And we really don't know what the long-term implications of that. But we do know that when you block stomach acid, the acid has a reason why it's there. And the first thing is that it protects us against food poisoning. So microbes, parasites, fungi that come in on our food, it can break those down. It's also used for the beginning process of digesting proteins, which come in amino acids that can be 22,000 amino acids long, and it starts cleaving those so that the pancreatic enzymes have an easier job of like breaking those down into tiny usable peptides that we can use. And so if those things don't happen, then protein digestion gets a lot more difficult and we open ourselves up to infection. And we know that people who take proton pump inhibitors long-term, they have a lot more SIBO. They have a lot more fungal overgrowth. And then the final couple big, you know, coup de grace is that we use that acid in the duodenum, which is when the food leaves the stomach and goes into the first part of the small intestine. That acid actually helps us absorb calcium and iron and potassium mm-hmm. and magnesium and manganese and zinc and, you know, all of our minerals. So
there's actually even a black box warning on these medications that say that they may cause magnesium deficiency. So, which is such a common problem in America. People just don't consume enough magnesium. This is making it worse. That's bad for our hearts, increases the risk for cardiac arrhythmias and, you know, cardiac diseases.
And our muscles and our mind and our ability to withstand stress. Because when people are magnesium insufficient, they're more anxious and their muscles are tighter and they feel more tense. Mm-hmm. You know, magnesium is used for over 300 different functions in the body. And so when we don't have it, those don't happen. But the same thing, you know, like, when somebody's anemic, we say, oh, take your iron with a little bit of orange juice or tomato juice. Why? Because it has acid in it. Mm-hmm. And so people end up becoming mineral depleted, so it can contribute to bone loss and other kind of mineral insufficiencies.
That's I guess, the essence of your chapter on osteoporosis. Because, you know, I was like, okay, I get it about... you know, the relationship between skin disorders, autoimmune disorders, but in osteoporosis, there's a big nutritional and inflammatory component. And so the gut has a role in the absorption of the critical nutrients for bone.
Yeah. And also that there's a relationship between serotonin and bone formation as well.
Oh, okay.
And we make a lot of serotonin in our brain, but we make most of it in our gut. And so the balance of serotonin is also really important for bone health. So anyway, I think, you know, PPIs, sometimes people do need them in an emergency short term, but I'd rather people try acupuncture and breathing exercises and going and getting a massage or using something like DGL licorice or you know, any of the kind of gamma orizonol, which is a oil from rice bran that Japanese research has demonstrated.
It's inflammatory disorders in the GI tract.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, like with this, like with anything, I think in functional medicine, integrative medicine, we're always asking the question, why is this happening? Not just what is it called? And so for everybody, that might be a little different. And so, you know, the what makes you feel best might be different too. And I think some people with GERD also might have H. pylori infection that's giving them GERD, and other people might have a diaphragm that's kind of pushed out of place, causing what's called a hiatal hernia. And in that case, sometimes people with GERD, all they really need is a couple of osteopathic or chiropractic manipulations, and their GERD's gone.
Yep, I've seen that done. It's a pressure delivered to a certain part of the abdomen that is people in osteopathic medicine and chiropractic are trained to do. I guess it's called visceral manipulation in osteopathic medicine. Is that what it's referred to as? Yeah, I think so.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of your favorite supplements for GI problems? I mean, it's obviously beyond the scope of this podcast to, go through all the GI ailments as you do in the book, and you have entire chapters devoted to treating various conditions. But, what are some of the top GI supplements you mentioned? Licorice extract, DGL. What are some others?
Others that I think are really important. Unlike our muscles and our brain, the small intestine main energy nutrient is glutamine. So if somebody has leaky gut or food sensitivities or skin reactions, it's one of my go-to nutrients would be powdered L-glutamine that people can put in their water bottle and take.
It's very easy on the stomach. It tastes sweet and it's not, unpalatable.
No. Or people can get that in a combination product where it might have some slippery elm or mallow or glucosamine in that for gut healing. And so, for somebody with leaky gut, that would be kind of my first ideas. They might also have some quercetin, because quercetin also helps heal leaky gut, and it's also a natural antihistamine. Mm-hmm. So that would be one. I also really love using probiotics that are specific for people. Mm-hmm. So my favorite probiotic is people eating real food, because when we eat fruits and vegetables, they naturally have good beneficial microbes on them.
They're prebiotics as well. They furnish nutrients to promote the growth of healthy bacteria.
Yeah, they're the food for the microbiome. So when we eat soluble fibers, which is another word for prebiotic or resistant starch, we feed the microbiome. So, the first most important supplement is eating really healthy foods, probiotic and prebiotic rich foods. But there's also, you can get some prebiotics as acacia fiber, or you can even use psyllium seed if you're constipated, like something like Metamucil, or larch. Fiber also has arabinogalactans. Yep. All of these things can really help heal the gut. And then probiotics, there's so many wonderful brands of probiotics. And now we're starting to see, as you say, we're starting to see some probiotics that may help more with anxiety, or may help more with mood, or may help more with somebody who has recurring bladder infections. So we're starting to see research and then products that are targeting specific conditions based on the research by which probiotics are in them.
Could you comment a little on the low FODMAP diet? Because I think that's in vogue, and that probably wasn't such a big topic in, your second and third edition, where you're now on the fifth edition of Digestive Wellness.
It didn't exist on the second or third edition. So the low FODMAP diet, I kind of am glad that we're coming back there, because, for you and I, who are pretty healthy, we want to eat a lot of high fiber foods and a lot of good quality prebiotic rich foods, root vegetables and potatoes and whole grains and fruits and nuts and seeds, and all of these things are going to really feed.
Artichoke and parsnips and
jicama.
Chicory.
Yeah.
And these are fibrous foods, but for some people they're problematic, right?
Yes. And so when we're working with somebody who has SIBO, or they have dysbiosis, or they have fungal infections, or they have irritable bowel syndrome, what we're going to see is they're going to start eating these foods, and they're just going to get more gas and bloating and more discomfort. And so, again, that's a diagnostic. If you can't eat those foods, then it says, aha, you do want to maybe try a low FODMAP diet, or you want to try a Atkins type diet to minimize carbohydrates. The low FODMAP diet was developed by Dr. Sue Shepherd and Peter Gibson at the University of Monash in Australia. And they started with a hypothesis. What if we put people on a low prebiotic rich diet? What will happen? And what they've discovered is that for people with irritable bowel syndrome and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO, that putting somebody on a low FODMAP diet for a period of like 4 to 6 weeks with very low FODMAPs, and then starting to reintroduce these prebiotic rich foods, you can figure out kind of, you can minimize their IBS, and you can also figure out what foods are problematic. And when you look at the FODMAP,
Liz, is for people to realize this is not a lifestyle. This is not a lifetime commitment. It's actually a trial diet. It's an experiment, and it's, to see if A, you respond. And if you respond, it really probably isn't necessary for you to eliminate all the, the full gamut of foods on the low FODMAP diet. Try and reintroduce foods as you tolerate them. But maybe you'll discover that, a couple of those foods are really the culprits.
Yeah. And, I think it's so important. I think with any therapeutic diet, these aren't lifestyle. The Mediterranean diet, that's a lifestyle. And we can all kind of adhere mostly to a good Mediterranean diet. But when we're going on the FODMAPs, when I say it's a low prebiotic rich food, FODMAP stands for F, which is
fructans,
which are prebiotics. The O is oligosaccharides, which are prebiotics. They're the starches in a lot of these foods. D is disaccharides, which are also, which are also things like lactose, which is actually a prebiotic. All these sugars. And so the FODMAP diet is really low prebiotic rich. And what we see is, yes, you will actually starve out those bad, dysbiotic, not good for you microbes. And then you can start eating more normally. And you probably also want to work with a really good doctor who can say, oh, well, do you need any herbs like oil of oregano or berberine containing herbs to help you get rid of that infection? Or do you need medications to help you get rid of that infection? And how do we heal the leaky gut? And, to really get some guidance and coaching in how to do it. Because we know that after 4 weeks on the FODMAP diet, that your microbiome splits. We see that the kind of gassy, bloaty things that cause the IBS-like symptoms, that those microbes, they start going down, but we also start seeing that the bifidobacteria that are so helpful for us, they start really going down. And so we never want to stay on these diets long term.
There's actually a word that's been applied to this, which is Gibson's conundrum. Peter Gibson, the discoverer of this in Australia at Monash University, said, it's therapeutic, but the conundrum, the dilemma is we don't want to so thoroughly suppress those bacteria, because long-term that may be less healthy, because you need those bacteria to make healthy short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, which really heal the gut. So, eventually we may want to return to a more moderate intake of some of these previously problematic foods.
We do things differently when we don't feel well than when we feel well. And these diets are designed to really help bring us back towards optimal health, and over time to really help us to be able to broaden what we can eat as we heal our leaky gut and we start balancing our microbiome again. And the same is true also of the ketogenic diet. I have students who've been on the ketogenic diet for years and they feel amazing on it. But we're starting again, see all these papers saying, you know, long term, it may actually increase some of the inflammatory microbes in the gut and reduce butyrate. And so, you know, all of these, they were really designed to be short term. Mm-hmm. And what I like about all these diets is that they put the power into your own hands as a patient, mm-hmm. you know, as a person. And they're not only therapeutic, but they're diagnostic. They really help you to figure out what's going on and why. And so you might discover, oh man, every time I eat a gluten-containing grain, I'm depressed for 3 days, or I have the runs for 3 days. And so you can say, wow, was that worth it? Well, sometimes that piece of pizza might be worth it. And sometimes you, after a while, you go, you know what? That piece of pizza is rarely going to be worth having 3 days of depression or runs. Mm-hmm. You know, so it puts the power in your own hands. And then as you heal, as your gut heals, your whole system, your whole body starts feeling better. And then the hope is that some of those foods that made you feel poorly before might not make you feel bad if you eat them occasionally, or even put them back in your regular diet.
Well, it's no coincidence that your clinical focus during your entire career has been digestion, because it's so central to overall health. And if we've thrown a lot of ideas and material at you, it's all beautifully and elaborately elucidated in the book, Digestive Wellness. It's a comprehensive book. That this book available to the general public, and it's just come out, right?
Yeah, it just came out, and it's available if you ask your local bookstore to get it or any of the online sites. And you can find out a little more about it at digestivewellnessbook.com, and also download an elimination guide.
Okay, so I recommend that you folks out there get it, read it. But then, you know, don't come back and see me and then run circles around me in the office because you've just read all this information and I haven't memorized the entire book yet. Patients these days are becoming so well informed because of the availability of resources like Digestive Wellness. It's amazing. It's really been a revolution in knowledge about what's going on with our bodies.
Isn't that fantastic? Because every time someone comes into your office, they teach you something new. And then the next person who walks in says, they have the same problem. And you go, hey, have you tried this? And it's really great.
And that's how we make progress. Liz, congratulations. Liz Lipsky, the author, today's guest. Congratulations on, you know, a marvelous career and yet another wonderful iteration of Digestive Wellness. I'm sure you're going to help a lot of people and teach a lot of practitioners through that book.
Thanks, Ron. It was so fun to be on this call with you today. And, you know, we're all doing our own little piece to try to improve people's health one at a time.
Oh, absolutely. And you're certainly doing some heavy lifting. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. For decades, I've been preaching about the importance of a regimen of basic supplements that everyone should consider part of their daily health routine. So I came up with an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. The very same supplements I take myself and prescribe for my patients. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com and check out my Intelligent Medicine Starter Kit. It's a short list of the basic supplements that I recommend as a starting point for those looking to take control of their health. They're the essential elements of a basic program that everyone could benefit from. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DearHoffmanStore.com.